Pushkin. I first heard Burhana watching Donald Glover's show, Atlanta. It's one of the few shows I know I'm going to discover new music when I watch it. Some tracks don't stand up to repeat listens outside of the show, but Burhana was one of the artists from the second season I kept going back to.
Hey, Mrs. Hubert, you think that they should hang with us? Can't feel my music, we used to dance out the lonely us.
Burhana's voice really stands out in modern R&B. While pretty much everyone else these days sings with a whispery, atmospheric falsetto, Burhana has a crisp tenor, and it sounds refreshing. Burhana doesn't mind being different. He's first-generation American, born in Atlanta to Ethiopian parents, so he's always felt a bit out of place anyway. Still, he managed to find his people and eventually his sound. As you'll hear in this episode, the song you're listening to, Janet, is an ode to the original dark-skinned Aunt Viv from The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. I sat down with Burhana at Village Studios in LA to talk about how a young artist can go from working bad restaurant gigs to earning enough on music to eke out a living, and how he ended up in Tokyo to record most of his album, Han. This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond. Here's my conversation with Burhana. But first, he starts off with a performance of the song that got me hooked, Grey Love.
Whiskey trickled down the suede. Close my tab and hit your place. Stumble through the swivel gaze. Dab your doorman on the way. My golden elevator ways. Three bumps while it elevates. 40 stories up in space. 40 stories up in space. But I'm fiending for your energy. Snap out it when I'm sober. You used to be my lovely. Them lovely days is over, over. Great love, hungover Sunday love. Come over, no stay love. Maybe someday, day love, great love. Come over, no stay love. Hungover Sunday love. Maybe someday. Sliding through your marble floors. Risky business, judgment warped. Solace in your innermost. But it's all the same thing. Ask me why I'm always high. Roll up for I answer why. You say that it's time I go. I'm flying 40 stories down below. But I'm fiending for your energy. Snap out it when I'm sober. You used to be my lovely. But them lovely days is over, over, over. Great love, hungover Sunday love. Come over, no stay love. Maybe someday, day love, great love. Come over, no stay love. Hungover Sunday love. Maybe someday, day.
Yo, that was amazing, man.
Oh, thank you, man.
That was beautiful.
Appreciate you.
Yeah, so that was an acoustic version, stripped down version of Grey Love,
yep.
Which is from your first project, your EP.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called Burhana, self-titled.
Exactly, yeah.
And that song is actually how I first discovered you, like I'm sure many people, because it got featured on Donald Glover's show, Atlanta.
Yep.
That must have been huge for an up-and-coming artist like
it
you.
Was,
at the time, you might not have even been up-and-coming. You were just someone putting out music.
Yeah.
I mean, it must have been massive.
It was crazy. It was crazy for a few different reasons. That show was my favorite show on television by far. I was like super in tune with it. I loved the writing. I'm from Atlanta. Donald's one of my favorite artists. So just all of that, you know, happening at once was a very cool moment for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know like a lot of younger artists like look for placements and find placements. Mm. How big are placements for like an artist like you?
I think it, you know, it depends on like the show. It depends if it's like a movie, commercial, you know, it's all different. I don't go out of my way to like get placements. I think there are a lot of people that do. They're like, oh, this movie is looking for these style songs. You know what I'm saying? Like,
Yeah,
I remember when 50 Shades of Grey came out, I was with this other team at the time and they were like, oh, like 50 Shades of Grey, like you just gotta make something a little sexy and da da da. And I was like, oh, I'm not about to do that, you know?
Yeah. That'd be a bad look, man.
Yeah, exactly. But to like have your own song that feels like you.
Yeah.
And then someone else takes that, that's cool. That's not going out of my way for it feels better.
Absolutely. So another reason that must have been like important and big for you is because you weren't initially trying to be a musician or be, you know, like play music for a living. You were trying to be a screenwriter.
Yeah.
And that's like, so it's like kind of your two worlds colliding in a way, like this amazing show with your music. How did you get into screenwriting?
My sister. That's like the easiest answer. My sister is 12 years older than me. And she kind of like shaped who I am. She went to NYU, but she would always like come home for extended amounts of time just to like stay with me and still be present in my life, and would put me onto different movies she really liked and television shows, and would break down A stories, B stories, C stories. Like she wow. already knew what like she wanted me to be in a way. Like we kind of joke about that all the time. But I was like, oh, I want to go to NYU. I want to be in the dramatic writing program. And that was like, I was like, oh, that's what I want to do. I love TV. I love film. So I was like, oh, I just want to like write. For the rest of my life, I just want to write. And I did music, but it was more so like a passion project. It was for me. I'd show a couple friends here and there, but I never thought it was going to be the driving force by any means.
And what were the first songs you wrote?
The first song I wrote was about like my dad who like left. I was like 7 or 8. My sister had left the house at the time, but my brother was still there. And it was to no music. It was just like story. It was just like writing. I wasn't playing piano. I was just like creating the melody and just writing the thing. And I showed my brother, and he was the first person to really encourage me when it came to music. Cause he saw it as like almost like a journal. He was like, yo, you have to make sure that you keep doing this and letting out how you feel this way. He was like, I had no idea you felt like this. And that was the first song I wrote.
That's amazing to start trying to write songs at 7. What were you, I mean, and Atlanta is, you grew up in Atlanta, and that's like such a diverse musical town. Totally. Like there's so much music going on and all kinds of music. You know, people I think now just think of like trap music or whatever, but like, there's so much kinds of music going on in Atlanta. So was there just a lot of music going on in your home or?
In my home, yeah, there was a bit of music. I'd say like there was a lot of like oldies, like Sam Cooke. My mom loved like Stevie Wonder. There was also like Ethiopian music being played a bunch. And then whatever my brother was listening to, whether it was like BC Boys or Outkast. And my sister as well used to always make me CDs, mix CDs. So, and we were in the church, but I didn't have like, you know, one of those parents. I was like, listen to all of Prince's discography. Like, this is amazing. You have to understand why. I didn't have that. And I think the first thing I gravitated towards was storytelling. It was just like, oh, they're telling a very like unique story. I like how the words sound together. And that's what drew me in first.
How steeped in Ethiopian culture were you growing up as a kid?
It was interesting growing up in Atlanta. And like being first generation African, because you go home and it's, you know, the smells are Ethiopian. The language that you're hearing your parents speak in is from Ethiopia. The decor, you know, everything is Ethiopia. And then you like walk outside and it's like this Georgia. So there's like this Southern pride aspect. And it's also Atlanta. So it's like very black and it's like very proud as well. So to be in like these three different worlds at once was, it was a lot at times, but as an observer, I began to like really take it all in and appreciate it as, you know, the older I got.
Yeah, because those are three really strong cultures.
Exactly,
like,
yeah.
Like, you're just like, I didn't even think about that part, because I think of Atlanta sometimes as like on an island, you know, same as like New Orleans. But yeah, there's like that southern sort of element to it too, right? Yeah. Especially if you're not specifically in Atlanta, exactly. If you grew up right outside of it. Like, did you ever feel, I don't know, so I know a lot of first generation kids sometimes struggle with feeling like, you know, maybe you don't want to accept your heritage because you want to sort of just, you want to fit in at school, you totally. Know? So did you ever find yourself wanting to be more, fit into more one culture than the other, or
yeah, totally. There were definitely different times, because I went to a school. My mom put me in this private school that was predominantly white, that she worked at so that I could go to the school. But I remember once there was like a show and tell, and my mom brought some different Ethiopian food, and like kids were like spitting it up, like, "What is this? What is some of my favorite foods, mind you, like some of my favorites?" And then seeing that made me feel like, you know, ashamed. Because I was really young at the time, and I was like, oh, I guess this isn't good, so I don't want kids to come over and smell my house and eat the food we have. I'd rather go to your house.
You know? Right, yep.
So there was a lot of that when I was really young. And then the older I got, the more that just, like, went away.
Yeah.
And I found a community of a lot of different, like, first-generation Africans through church and sports. We became super close. And those were the people I really identified with, even though they weren't Ethiopian or they didn't go to the same schools or whatever. It was just, oh, we share that thing of being in different worlds at once.
Yeah, you sure being different in this place.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
That's heartbreaking, man.
Yeah, yeah.
Food, that's just like,
yeah,
it feels like such a rejection.
The one that spit out the food, it wasn't even crazy like food. It was like ginche. It's like kind of like similar to like rice or couscous. It's like something that no one should spit out. Just like right. Some dumb kid.
Something really tame.
Yeah, yeah. His name was Casey.
It's not Dura Watt. So you remember the name still, Casey.
Yeah. Yeah, his name's Casey. Punk.
Man. I saw you went to Ethiopia recently, right?
I did, yeah.
How often do you go back there?
That's my first time, actually.
First time?
A month ago, yeah. Yeah, I had an opportunity to do a show over there. My mom hadn't been back for 47 years.
Wow.
So I was like, this is the time. We should both go. And I got to bring her with me and see the country through her eyes. And it was a surreal experience.
And how did you connect with Mulatu Astaki out there, man? That's insane.
Yeah, that was amazing.
Brilliant Ethiopian musician, like incredible discography.
Incredible, absolutely. He's been one of my favorites since I was young. That was one of the ones my mom put me onto at an early age. And Albie, a girl from our team, who's right incredible. She's right over here. Yep. She made that happen. She knew I really liked Mulatu, and she had a connection. Yeah, she got us some time so we could sit down and really chop it up. Super thankful. It was crazy.
How was that time, man? What did he?
It was crazy, man. I like came to him, kind of like approaching him with an idea I wanted to do, and he was like, you know, kind of down, but then it totally flipped. It totally flipped. He was like, immediately went into, he just like taught me so much. It was like, we sat down for nearly 3 hours and he just talked to me about the history of music, how Ethiopia like plays into that, what instruments started in Ethiopia that no one knows about. And he's really like championing this kind of like, no one really knows like that much about Ethiopian music and its history, including Ethiopian people.
Yeah.
And he really wants to educate others. And he did that. He taught me so much. It was crazy.
That's amazing. That's like sitting down with like the Ethiopian Quincy Jones. You
exactly,
know?
Yeah. Like, I just shut up. I barely talked those 3 hours.
What instruments are from Ethiopia? I didn't even realize there was.
The masinko is like a really big one. It's kind of like a cello. That was one of the things he said. He was like, oh, what came first, the masinko or the cello? And I was like, I guess the masinko, because just how he was phrasing the question. And then he kept doing that with different instruments, horned instruments, whatever it was. And then he would go into the history of it and how that instrument was built and which tribe made that instrument. There are a lot of unique instruments to Ethiopia.
That's amazing. Yeah, you can hear it when you listen to the music. It sounds like, it's like orchestras full of like instruments, you feel like, what is that? You
know,
either they're playing it in a way I've never heard this thing played, or it's a completely different instrument.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's such a beautiful like sound that it's just,
yeah,
you know, when you're not used to hearing those sounds, it just sounds especially just like like mystical or something, totally. You know? It's incredible. We'll be back with my interview with Brahana after a quick break. We're back with Brahana. So you had two siblings?
Yeah,
two siblings. And you're the youngest?
I'm the youngest, yeah.
And they're both putting you on to movies and TV shows and music.
Totally.
And so you decide you want to go study screenwriting. And are you making music in college or are you?
I was. When I got there, it was like I'd put music behind me. I remember I did one show in Atlanta right before I left where I just did like covers and a couple of my songs. And then after that, it was kind of like my, all right, and I'll come back to this later.
How'd the performance look? Like, what was it, just you and?
It was me and in a band of okay. like people I just like recruited who were great. But we rehearsed like maybe for a week and they like played this show with me for free. I had like no money. And then when I came to New York, I was like, all right, I'm going to put that behind me and I'm going to go all into this writing.
And did you put it behind you because did it go well or did it just feel
no,
like?
No, it went fine, but it was like, oh, this isn't what I'm pursuing. I'm going to New York
yeah.
to be successful in this field.
Got it.
So I was like, I'll just revisit this later. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I was just, for the most part, only doing writing, interning at shows. I'm doing a lot of different stuff at like UCB, Upright Citizens Brigade. And then into like my senior year, I started like getting kind of restless. Because I really wanted to do music, but I just didn't know how. There were a lot of like jazz school kids I'd been hanging out with, but it wasn't people I was like necessarily trying to make music with.
Right.
And then this one kid, his name was Jimmy. He had heard I like sang because I used to like go to the piano room downstairs at the dorm and play songs now and then, and people would come listen. And he was like, oh, we should just do something together, just for the fuck of it, see how it goes. And I was like, yeah, for sure, let's do it. And we did one song called Kingdom together for his project. And then it did pretty well. Like for the first time I'd ever like put out a song, it like got write-ups. So it was like doing really well for him. And I was like, oh, you know what? This is cool. I'm going to try and make my own stuff, or at least one song. I'm going to try and make one song under my name, see how it goes.
Right.
And then I wrote like basically the outline of Janet, the song I ended up putting on my EP. And I connected with this kid, his name's Sapphire, who also went to my school for jazz, but he had dropped out because he was like, I know exactly what I want to do. I don't need to like be in school for it. And I loved that. I was like, oh, this is cool. I want to work with you. I want to like see if we can create something. And we ended up making the full EP together.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So how did you write? So I love Janet too, because it's a, again, it's kind of combining both of your worlds, right? It's music and it's combining.
Totally.
Like, it's like it's clearly someone with a love for TV had to write that. And I think probably everyone our age grew up loving, like obsessed with the Fresh Prince. Yeah. So such a beautiful send up to Aunt Viv.
Yeah.
How did you come up with the idea for that? And how did it kind of develop?
I saw a tweet from one of my really close friends, who's one of those first generation kids I was talking about that I was super tight with in Atlanta. He tweeted, if you fuck with the light skin Aunt Viv, I can't trust you. And I thought it was so funny. I just like started laughing, you know, I retweeted it or whatever. But then it like kind of was this, I was like, man, what did happen? You know,
yeah.
It kind of like planted this seed. And then I started just researching, like going in like this wormhole of what is like, what happened? Why was she kicked off the show? Does anyone really know? Like, And then that led into being like, oh, this situation's kind of like fucked up. She hasn't worked in since that show, really.
Yeah, really?
She like has had small stuff, but like
she was so good in that show too.
Yeah, she was. And she was kind of like, yeah, excommunicated from this community she worked so hard to be a part of.
Yeah.
She had, you know, she was a really talented dancer, singer, actress, went to Juilliard, was in the first production of Cats on Broadway, finally snags this series regular on NBC, does so well, people love her, but because of a couple tiffs she gets in, NBC is like, you know what? No, you're crazy. We're gonna tell everybody you're crazy and you're off of this thing. And it's just like that, it all went away and it made me so sad. And I was like, wow, I want to write something about this. So I wrote the chorus first at my house in Atlanta over like my piano, and I was like, oh, this is, I'm going to keep going with this.
And then you called it Janet because mm-hmm. that's Janet
Hubert. Yeah, that's her real name.
Right, the actress who played the initial Aunt Viv.
Yeah.
Right, the OG Aunt Viv. And then the verses, are those about her too? Because it seems like the verses are maybe...
Yeah, that's all about her.
It's all about her.
It's okay. Funny, a lot of people, when I first put it out, it's like girls would come up to me and be like, oh, like, my name's Janet, or like, I want to be your Janet. And I was like, yo, this song completely went over your head. this is not about a love interest. This is not about anything of that sort. It's about, you know, it's an ode to Janet Hubert. And it's about like being forgotten and what that's like and how I'm afraid of that, you know?
You're afraid of being forgotten.
Yeah, of course.
Ah, man. That's good songwriting, man, because it's like, it's about something so specific and because the dressing around it sounds so great, it's like, you can hear almost whatever you want to hear in it, you know?
Yeah.
Like you could hear that song and totally think it was about, you know, being left behind by a lover or, you know, it just depends on certain...
That's cool.
I love that it's open for interpretation.
That's always been my favorite stuff. And it took me a long time to be like, okay, this is what it means to me. Because I like that people are taking away their own things. That's one of my favorite things about music. And something that I did with like the music I was listening to when I was younger in college, even now, it's like I make my own interpretations and that's what makes it special.
Yeah, all the time. Sometimes I like to look at lyrics and then sometimes I don't. Sometimes I'm disappointed. Not that the lyrics are bad, but I'm like, wow, I thought this whole time this was about this and I identified it with this. And when I was feeling this way, I put this on and it made me feel so like, you know, so exactly. good, you know? And you're like, oh, it's like ruined now, you know? And I don't want to ruin it, you know?
Totally. That's the same reason why I don't look up lyrics a lot of the time. It's because I don't want it to be ruined.
So when you put out the EP, you worked with Sapphire. What was your intention for that? Just to put it out or?
Yeah, my intention was, well, a little bit before I'd put out the EP, I was working on it, but I wasn't fully in. I was still doing so many other things. And I remember I was sending in a lot of like different packets, like applying to shows.
And, like writing packets.
Writing packets. Right. And there was one show I thought I was going to get. And I was like, oh, if I get this, I'm going to go all in with this and I'll like marinate on the EP and I'll, you know, it'll come out when it comes out.
What show was it?
It was Colbert when he like took over
The late
Letterman
show?
Spot. Yeah.
The Letterman spot, yeah.
And then I ended up not getting it and I was like, oh, I'm going to finish this EP right now. I was like, there's nothing else I want to do. I'd stopped sending in packets at that point. And I was like, all right, here I go. I'm just going to go for it. I'm going to put this out. I'm going to move to LA before it comes out. And then I'm going to see where it goes. And it went fine. It was a slow burn.
You put it out. You weren't on a label at the time, right? Or were you?
I wasn't on a label. No. I had just gotten managers like after I'd already finished the project. And they were like, oh, yeah, you should put this on Spotify and all these different, you know, Apple Music, whatever, whatever. And then
you're out here in LA.
And then I got a job in a restaurant in LA. And then it slowly just built.
What was the tipping point moment for that? Like, when did it start? Because at some point that caught fire. When did?
It's funny. I was working at this restaurant in LA that I really hated. But I'd worked in a restaurant in New York where I'd, like, you know, worked up from a server to chef to assistant manager. So I was making like good money for where I was at.
Right.
But then I went to LA and it was the same style restaurant, but they were like, nah, you're going to be a busser and you have to train for like a month. And when you're training, you get no money. You get like you get paid shit. So I was still in that phase. And I remember Tyler, the creator, came into the restaurant and I was like, you know, someone I like look up to, an artist I look up to. And I was just like, damn, this is not, I'm trying to meet Tyler, the creator, you know what I'm saying? I was like, so I'm just avoiding his table at all costs. And then my boss is like, yo, I want to see you wipe down this table, which is like kind of close to his table. And I was like, fine, dude, whatever. Like head down, go wipe the table. And then this man yells at me because he's like, you didn't get the sides. So he like shows me how to like wipe the sides of a table. He's like, look, takes the rag and like does it. And I was like, oh, I'm gonna quit this week. I was like, this is the worst, like this is the worst feeling ever. And then it just so happened to be like that next week I got paid from my music just enough to like make it through 1 month. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. I'm gonna make sure I stretch this bitch out and not, I'm not about to get another job right now. And if I have to next month, cool. But it ended up being the next month, I got a little bit more than I got in the month before. And I was like, all right, we're gonna do the same thing. I'm gonna make, you know, peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, stay my ass inside, write. And then it kept like growing. That was the last time I had to work at a restaurant.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's incredible. And were you doing shows when at that point? Or
Nope.
So your money was just coming in from the EP?
From the EP, from streaming. Yeah.
Thank God for streaming, man.
Thank God, bro.
You know, I'm like,
thank God.
I love it.
Yeah, I was trying to put that EP out for free too. So I'm glad I didn't do that because it enabled me to, start doing this full time.
We'll be right back with Burhana after the break. We're back with Burhana performing his song, Golden.
The world has gotta say, I'm trying to make amends and stay alive. Heard some snakes is coming towards my way. Take a mongoose coast down 85. We're golden. We golden. We remember love in the summer. Take you to the cinema. Yellow halo above ya. It's something bigger than us. It's bigger than love. We golden. We go. I studied Kierkegaard and Badu. I studied God and what she once say. I studied everything about you. Even studied on a Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. We go, yeah. I love to love you, baby. No, no, no. I love to love you, baby. Yeah.
Cool.
Incredible. So where'd that Kierkegaard line come from, man?
Oh, that was college. In college, we were reading Kierkegaard in one of my philosophy classes. And his ideas on authenticity were something I really gravitated towards. And that's that line. That line's actually not even in the song that we put out. It was like
I was a
lost verse. Yeah.
I was gonna say, like, speaking of like not listening to lyrics, like I've listened to that song a bunch. I never heard that line till today.
Yeah. We were like, oh, you know what? Let's like stretch out the song a bit. And I haven't ever performed that verse. So I was like, oh yeah, let's do it here.
Thanks for doing that. First of all, I mean, I studied philosophy in college because I got into Kierkegaard and I loved it. And then I ended up not being able to study in the Kierkegaard in college. Like, they just didn't have any of that in the curriculum, and I was bummed. So that was great. And I just perked up on that because, I hadn't heard that.
That's sweet,
in the song. So how'd you come up with the idea to structure? So your new album, it's called Han, and this is your first actual album. Other one would be more of an EP.
Yeah.
And it's really cool because there's these little skits, and not like these extended rap skits, but there are like these cool little skits in between songs that kind of remind me of like Midnight Marauders or something, right? Like how there's like this lady guiding you through the album. In this case, it's a flight attendant. Mm. How'd you come up with that idea?
Midnight Marauders was one of my favorite albums growing up. And I thought I always wanted to do my own version of that, where it felt like a little more narrative based and I could put it in a space specifically. Mm-hmm. And so the concept of the album came before anything. When I write, it's like I go about it different ways, the process of it. But for this album, it was like, oh, I know what how I want the album to sound sonically. I know what I want the concept to be. And I know I want them to flow together seamlessly, and have all of these different sounds. Like, certain songs don't sound like other songs on the album, but they still feel like they come from the same world. And that's kind of, that was my starting point. Hmm. Yeah.
You used a band on this one, right?
Yeah, I used a lot of, a lot of like great musicians. Danny McKinnon, who's in here playing with me today. Pomo, he produced the entire record with me.
And how'd you connect with him?
He was someone I really wanted to get into a session with. Him and Danny both, actually. They were putting out a lot of like different videos, just them doing covers and like jamming. It wasn't even them putting out songs. They were putting out videos of just, you know, where they were and like what they were listening to. And it really, I was like, oh, I'm listening to the same things like right now. I was like, I really want to get in a session and see like what that's like. And then one session turned into like three sessions. And then I kind of finessed. I was like, threw out this idea like, oh, what if we did like a few songs and made it, you know, into its own project, knowing I wanted this to be the album. And, Pomo was so down. He was, that's like something that's really great about him as a producer. He loves like challenges. And even though I was throwing like a lot of different things his way, he was just really excited to do something he hadn't done before.
From the initial idea of it just being like a small project to becoming a full record, when did that?
In Japan. We went to Japan to record. I had a couple festival dates out there, and Danny came to play with us. Pomo came to play with us. And we just had this like whole group that we were already working on the album together. So we were like, oh, let's stay like a few more weeks, rent out a studio and just go as hard as we can.
In Japan. Wow.
And then when we were there, it was like, that's when it was like, oh, here's the outline. It's all right there. Now we just need to finish these songs.
In like Drunk, for instance, mm-hmm. which comes after Golden,
yep.
And you guys will play at some point today. The opening line is Drunk in Japan.
Drunk in Tokyo, yeah.
Drunk in Tokyo.
I do not know the language, nor how I know your name.
Right. And did going to Japan, did recording there, did that like change? Did that change the vibe of the recordings at all, or the sessions, or like what?
Yeah, for sure. I think it's whenever you're in a new place, it kind of opens you up. Like, you're not in the same routine. Everything's super new to you, especially a place like Japan where it's everybody looks different from you. Every store is different from any store you go to in America. It's a whole new world. So being in like that environment and like creating, you're going to get something different than you get when you're at home.
Right.
So it definitely informed everything that we were doing, for sure.
And the restaurant you were working at in New York was a Japanese restaurant.
Yep.
And you had to like learn some of the language there, right?
Yeah.
Is there like do you have an affinity for the culture there? Or is this all kind of accidental that you
totally.
Worked at a restaurant and had to learn some Japanese and that you ended up getting like dates in Japan?
Oh, yeah. It was super accidental. It was when I got the job. It was around the time where I was like, all right, I'm just doing this EP. I'm going to finish this. Da, da, da. And I was like, whoa, I'm broke. I need some money. So I'd applied to so many different jobs, couldn't get anything. Then I had a buddy in New York who was like, oh, I have this job. They're looking for people. But there's like a catch. They want you to speak Japanese. They want you to do this like 15-minute chant before shift starts that you have to learn. They want you to, it's like still very Japanese. All your bosses are going to be Japanese. They barely speak English.
But what's the chant you have to do before you start a shift?
It's crazy. Actually, if at the end of Golden, there's like, you kind of hear like this guy, this end of this chant. And that was me recording the actual chant that we did.
Can you, what is, do you remember any of it still?
I remember a little
bit.
No,
yeah. The whole 15 minutes, but you got like 20 seconds in you?
Yeah. Uchi no yona omise ga ippai aru no ni okyakusama wa uchi no mise uranande kureta densha ni notte wazawaza kite kurasatta atama o ikuku sagete mo maniawanai koshi o hikura hikuku shitemo otsukanai. Arigatai koto da, mottai nai koto da. Koshi o gyakusama ga. It's a long thing, bro. It's a very long thing.
To my untrained ear, that sounds like the accent's perfect too, man. It sounds like you're killing
it. It's crazy, bro. And I was working like 40-hour weeks. And if you do like the lunch shift and the dinner shift, that's 30 minutes every day.
You're are you getting paid for that part? Are you on the clock?
We're on the clock, thank okay, God. But yeah, it was a very intense environment.
Do you know what it means? Environment. Or are you just, is it just, it's just like kind of
I know like the gist. I don't know exactly. I don't know everything. My Japanese used to be way better when I was there. But yeah, that kind of like kicked off the affinity, I guess, for Japan. It was never, you know, there are a lot of musicians in particular and artists who will say that, like I said, with this album, a big starting point for me was Japanese funk. And I feel like there are a lot of artists who'd be like, oh, like, I just heard this like Japanese funk from the 80s. It's so weird and unique. I'm going to use this as a starting, you know, kind of fetishizing this thing where for me, it was like, oh no, all of my bosses were Japanese, only spoke Japanese. They would tell me like, yo, you should read this book by Ryunosuke Akutagawa, or you should watch this movie by Yasujiro Ozu, or you should listen to this album by Yukihiro Takahashi. Or like, they would put me onto because of that, then I was like, oh, this author is really tight. Who did he inspire? Or this filmmaker is really tight. Who are his contemporaries? And it kind of, I kind of kept going down that. So that's how I got inspired, you know? It's because of the environment I was in.
Wow.
Yeah.
This is like putting you in like a whole fourth other culture.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, totally.
That's also very strong and distinct.
Totally.
So you were listening to all that stuff even before you went out there to record. So that must have been kind of fun to be able to record out there. That what gave you the idea to say like, hey, let's try to rally the troops and do it?
Yep, absolutely.
Cool, man.
Definitely.
Want to do Drunk?
Yeah, let's do it.
And this is about your first trip to Japan, right?
First and second. Both combined into one.
Great.
Yeah.
Why am I so paranoid? Can't be so. Drunk in Tokyo, I do not know the language, nor how I know your name. Just slip past the guards and in past this godless garden, it's all the same. 7-7, all the same. Tweak until she tell me she drunk in Tokyo with no place to go. Don't know how she, I swear I seen you dance. Was it in Paris, France? Come towards the water, babe. And then it's all on me. High in Tokyo, my head is so low. These police don't play no games. Just did my first show, I saw you front row. Don't know how I know your name. Excuse me if it's rude to say. Smiled and then she told me she high in Tokyo, her life in slow-mo. Don't know how she, I swear I seen you dance. Was it in Paris, France? Towards the water, babe. And then it's all on me. I swear I seen you dance. I swear I seen you dance. Was it in Paris, France? My lovely dark romance. Come towards the water, babe. Run to the waves of gold. Don't throw your heart away. I thought I'd let you know.
Cool. Oh, thank you for doing this, guys.
Of course,
yeah, appreciate for sure.
It. Yeah. It's all over?
That's it, man. Thanks to Berhana for taking us through his first two projects and sharing some of that incredible Japanese chant with us. Be sure to check out his album Han, along with our other favorite Berhana songs on a playlist we created at brokenrecordpodcast.com. You can also find a playlist we had him put together of some of his favorite Japanese city pop. And be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/brokenrecordpodcast. We're always putting up our old interviews there and our new ones, sometimes with bonus content. Broken Record is produced with help from Jason Gambrell, Mila Bell, Leah Rose, and Martin Gonzalez for Pushkin Industries.
The theme music's by Kenny Beats. I'm Justin Richmond. Thanks for listening.